Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Same show here on the Head On Radio Network. It's been a pleasure as always. Thanks to Billy Shears, our music director. Proud member of the Head On Radio Network. And don't forget, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. Have a great weekend, gang. See you next week.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. There is a lot going on this week. I'm glad to be back. And most important coming on in this hour will be my interview with Congressman Sestak of Pennsylvania. He's a new congressman. He was elected in 2006. Most definitely to oppose the war in Iraq. He's also, in fact, the highest military man in the Iraq. He was the deputy secretary of the Navy, and he is the highest military man in Congress, I should say, in the House of Representatives. I want to play my interview with him because he's someone that I'm challenging on the war in Iraq, not because he disagrees with me about bringing the troops home, but because he's someone who, like most Democrats, doesn't want to cut off funding, doesn't want to do what might be called the nuclear option because he's afraid of the president playing chicken with the troops. And if you listen to the interview, you'll see how it segues into a conversation about contempt, because it seems to me this is a Congress that is not exercising its power as much as it can. Now, there's two ways to deal with a Democratic Congress. Well, I guess three ways to deal with a Democratic Congress that's caving. One way is to elect a Democratic president. If we had a President Obama or even a President Clinton in the January 2009, I have no doubt that Congress would do the right thing. They want to do the right thing. They're just hesitant about exercising their power against a president who opposes them. So that's one way. The second way is to do what I've done in this interview and what I'll play for you, where I give the reasons and go over them with the member of Congress and try patiently and somewhat impatiently to persuade him to use his power under the Constitution to do the right thing. And then there's a third way, a way that I find unproductive, and it's the way that is done by, yes, some, a woman who's a hero to many who oppose the war in Iraq, Cindy Sheehan. Cindy Sheehan, of course, is the mother of Casey Sheehan, who died serving the United States in Iraq, and she passionately wants the war in Iraq to end, as do I. But her way of fighting it is to run against Nancy Pelosi in San Francisco, California, which she has a right to do. I don't really mind that as much as I mind the fact that she's allying herself with some terrorist movements. Now, you don't have to ally with a terrorist movement in order to oppose the war in Iraq. I'm going to have the famous peace mom on my show tomorrow, and I'm going to ask her about this, sharing her goal of getting our troops home from Iraq, but wondering whether she has the right tactics. I've argued all along that tactics matter. There was a march in Washington just a couple weeks ago, and even though 60% of Americans, 180 million Americans, more in fact, 63%, oppose the war in Iraq, they couldn't get a million, they couldn't get 100,000, they couldn't get 1,000. 23 organizations sponsored a peace march, and a mere 100 in some showed up, perhaps 5 per organization. And that's one of the things I want to raise with Cindy Sheehan tomorrow, which is whether or not a tactic that causes 99.9999% of Americans opposed to the war in Iraq to not want to join her movement, maybe she shouldn't be our leader. Or maybe she shouldn't associate with people who take away the common agenda of opposing the war in Iraq and add all these other agendas that the vast majority of Americans do not support. But before we get to her tomorrow, I want to show up today and share my interview with Congressman Sestak, because it shows at least how I am trying to persuade members of Congress to do the right thing. Cindy Sheehan has her tactic. I have mine, where I explain to the congressman what his powers are under the Constitution. He is a new congressman. He's only been there about a year. Explaining him not only that he has these powers, but that I think he should use these powers, and you'll hear how he tries to avoid using those powers. And then there's a lot more to talk about this week. I hope we will have time to do so. Everything from the Millionaire's Amendment before the United States Supreme Court. Do you know about that? This is a very good amendment. It was part of the McCain-Feingold bill that equalizes the playing field for elections. And, of course, multimillionaires oppose it because what it does, in effect, is it makes it a fair race rather than letting money buy power. Other stuff going on, we have the Army and the Marines admitting more serious criminals into our military. They're having so much trouble finding cannon fodder for Iraq that they're hiring people who've committed felonies and serious misdemeanors. Just what I want, a guy convicted of armed robbery going and serving his country in Iraq. And then we wonder why things like Abu Ghraib happened. Also, if there's time, I want to talk about Carter in Israel, like Carter talking with Hamas. I think Jimmy Carter, frankly, is either extremely naive or extremely disingenuous. Either he's lying or he's duped. I happen to think he's duped, but it's a very dangerous duping when the President of the United States says something that, you know, Hamas is ready to live with Israel, and on the exact same day, the leader of Hamas says Carter's dead wrong. We want to destroy Israel. I'm not sure what Carter's smoking. It might be hopefulness. And if there's time, let's go over the infamous quote of Barack Obama that has been so trumpeted in the media, the one about people being bitter in Pennsylvania because of nation's economic policies and clinging to guns, clinging to God. He's really gotten a lot of abuse for this. And, you know, if you look at what he's trying to say, perhaps inartfully put, I don't really see a problem with it. I do see a problem, though, with those that are giving him abuse, because they're kind of false populists. But let me start with my interview with Congressman Sestak of Pennsylvania. It kind of starts in the middle. I apologize for that. It was recorded on my show, my local radio show in Washington, and it was sort of started in the middle, unfortunately. But as you can hear most of the debate. Very little is lost. The heart of it is I'm pressing him on why Congress hasn't stopped funding for the president's war in Iraq. Here's the interview.
To do it safely.
Well, here's the problem, Congressman. As you and I both well know, Congress cannot wield a scalpel. The president can wield a scalpel. Congress can wield a sledgehammer. The only power Congress really has is the power to stop funding the war. And if Congress were to do that, or say, for example, the funding ends after a year, the president then would have a choice. He could either use the remaining funds to withdraw the troops, or the president could play chicken with America's troops. Don't you think the only way to stop this president, not necessarily another president, but this president, would have been for Congress to use the sledgehammer?
Do you trust the president?
No.
Then why are you asking me to trust the president play chicken with the troops? How can anyone ever ask that question of me? I served with him overseas, and if you think I'm going to trust the president to blink and leave the troops with no money to fight back, I will never do that. But what I will do, and I have done, is vote for a bill that will say no more money to be authorized after a year, or a bill that says 15 to 24 months. I will do that, and have. But the fact of the matter is we didn't have the votes to get it past the veto. But when I voted last May, the money was going to run out in July, and we voted to appropriate enough money for four more months. There's no way the troops could get out by September safely. I won't play chicken. with our troops. But if you don't trust them, why is anyone asking me to?
I guess here's the problem. What that means is that, in effect, Congress gives president all the cards, largely because, let's be fair, because the president is willing to risk American lives in a way that Congress is not, because the president is irresponsible, he can hold that irresponsibility over Congress, and the troops suffer, America suffers, and Congress, which under the Constitution has the right to declare war, and presumably the right to stop a declaration of war, is rendered impotent, isn't it?
Not at all. The Congress had the wrong strategy a year ago in May. The question is not about bringing the troops home, however emotionally appealing that is, and correct that may be. The real question is, how do you end this war appropriately so America's overall security is enhanced? And so to do that, you have to begin a redeployment without a question of at least one, and I believe two brigade combat teams a month. I don't disagree with that. I've said it since the day I've gotten in, because only by a redeploying them will you show the Iraqis that they have to step up to play and assume responsibility. But there were not the votes.
And your position, to be fair, is consistent with both Barack Obama's and Hillary Clinton's.
Without a question. I am a date certain guy. I still believe setting a date when I came into Congress and I put a bill in that said December 31st, 2007, no money will be authorized for 1 cent in Iraq. But since that time, we put 42,000 more troops into Iraq. So now my bill says, I changed it to a bipartisan vote, because the fact of the matter is we didn't have the vote. So here's what I believe, that we have to get five more brigade combat teams out immediately, more than Petraeus, General Petraeus, wants to do. If you get 10 brigade combat teams out, you now have an army at home that is actually ready to deploy elsewhere in the world. And number two, I think we could demonstrate, which if we had done this properly and not let the Petraeus report in September be the Petraeus report, but to be the report about the impact of Iraq on America's overall security, and had the chairman, had the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had the head of the CIA, had the head of the Treasury Department, and held up that mirror to the nation, we probably would have done better and more good for providing, which the Constitution requires Congress does, for the, quote, common defense, unquote. We failed.
I agree with you, Congressman, because you're losing, let's face it, you're losing the propaganda battle. Americans are tired of the war, and they're not just blaming Republicans. They're blaming Democrats, too. They say, hey, we elected you to end this war, and you're giving Bush, admittedly, because Bush is, you know, inflexible, because he's stubborn, because he's willing to play chicken with the troops, whatever reason, you're giving him a blank check.
No, here's what I believe, all right? What I believe is we forgot, or the party forgot, that this is not a democracy in America. It's a representative democracy. Take Senator Hagel.
Right.
He is a conservative Republican from Nebraska.
Right.
He opposes this war.
Right.
But his polling right now will probably show he couldn't get reelected. He's not rerunning for other reasons probably. But the reality of the issue here is Congress had another responsibility, which you said. It should have demonstrated to the nation better than it had. It wasn't just about getting the troops home. It was about this strategy is harming our overall strategy. We forgot that we had to reach across the aisle in order to have enough votes in a representative democracy where many Republicans come from districts that even though the overall American polls show that they want to end the war, there are those that come from districts that they have enough votes that support the president or are hesitant about doing it too immediately. If we had demonstrated more clearly by taking advantage of having not General Petraeus come before us, that he set almost against the spirit of the Constitution, a man who's singularly responsible only for Iraq security, he set the tone of the debate for the nation's national security. We failed to hold up, as you said. I don't call it propaganda. I had a mirror that said, look at the harm it's doing.
So what does Congress need to do? Do you think that the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, they need to hold hearings?
Without a question.
Okay, so why haven't the party in control of Congress, your party, my party, the Democratic Party, why haven't they done this?
I proposed this back in July before the first and also over the last 4 months.
Is it Pelosi and Reid? I mean, are they the ones stopping this? Is it Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid that are in the way, or is it someone else?
I was told by the leadership that the administration would not provide the witnesses. Now,
So what?
I don't
you could
know
subpoena them?
Witnesses those were, but all I know is this. It should have been a cause celebre of why we could not get the witnesses before us in order to ask those hard, penetrating questions in the public purview. Is it true, as they've said, is that we cannot deploy the army in order to defend 28,000 troops in South Korea? What is the impact upon us when 42% of our youth coming into America are less capable of handling the sophisticated weaponry that they will need to handle 20 years from now? What's that long-term risk? And by having set that as part of the Petraeus hearing, I believe, and we didn't achieve this, we did not set the tone of the debate for national defense. So I take blame. I think we both parties, Titans of both parties, are to blame for not having the proper debate. It defaulted, unfortunately, to a single man, almost, as I said, against the spirit of the Constitution, to set the parameters of the debate on national security, and Iraq security became perceived as America's national security.
Congressman, let me suggest to you something else that I think is against the spirit of the Constitution, and it relates to what you and I want to see done, which is a number of hearings, not just with Petraeus, but on Army readiness, on whether this is helping American security at all, whether, in fact, we are better off or whether we were better off in 2002 when a tin pot dictator named Saddam Hussein was in power, not a good guy, but less danger to American security than now. And that is, as you said, to have all these hearings, you have to use the subpoena power. Congress has the subpoena power, the power to force administration people to testify. Now, as you know well, the House Judiciary Committee subpoenaed Josh Bolton and Harriet Myers, and they refused to show. Harriet Myers, who was ostensibly a nominee for the United States Supreme Court, refused to obey the law. She told Congress, in effect, I don't give a damn about the Constitution. I don't care what you say. I'm not showing up. I have no respect for the law or for America. Now, at that time, the House, properly, voted to hold them in contempt. But it voted to hold them in contempt using the statute that allows the U.S. attorney to hold them in contempt. And the U.S. attorney also said, I'm not going to follow the law. George Bush told me not to follow the law. You know, forget you, Congress. There is a power, which I'm sure you know about, a power of inherent contempt. It is right there in the Constitution. It was used most recently in 1934 because, frankly, presidents since then have chosen to obey the law. Do you support using the power of inherent contempt, which basically means saying to members of the administration, if you won't testify before us, we will hold you in the Capitol building until you agree to testify? Do you support that, Congressman?
I have to be honest with you. I did not know about inherent.
Well, good. Then we're educating Congress here tonight.
You are. But, I mean, it actually says,
yes,
you're telling me that we can hold you,
yes,
in the Capitol.
Yes,
physically.
In fact, the sergeant at arms is your police force. It's not quite as big as the military or the Secret Service, but there used to be a jail at the bottom of the Capitol.
I know there used to be a jail. I'm
right.
Very aware of that.
That's
and
right.
I did know that they could do, I did not know it was called inherent condemn. I do
yes.
know of all that.
Yeah. It dates back to 1934. It hasn't been used since then, but there's a Supreme Court holding in 1934 that Congress has the inherent power under the Constitution.
Oh, okay. It's not in the Constitution. What you're saying, the interpretation of the Constitution by the Supreme Court.
That's
is
right.
It in it. Now I understand what you're saying.
That's what
okay.
I'm saying.
I had not known that there was words called inherent in the Constitution.
Yeah, no. It's
okay.
A Supreme Court opinion from 1934 that says Congress has the inherent power to compel obedience to its subpoenas. Today, since the 30s, we've used a U.S. attorney, but as you know, the U.S. attorney refuses to comply.
Okay, but what you're telling me is, at that time, the Supreme Court did not say, that means you can hold them and place them physically. What they said is, Congress has the inherent ability to compel.
That's
and
correct.
At some time, to compel, the Congress used its police force. So
that's correct.
Yeah, now I understand. I understand exactly what you're saying. I had thought you were saying this was in the Constitution. This is an interpretation by the Supreme Court.
Right, but it's one that's never been overturned. It is still good law. And my question for you is, would you support a resolution? And all it takes is the House to vote. You don't even need the Senate for this one.
To where the police force would then of the Capitol go over and hold them and grab them and hold them.
And hold them until they speak to you.
No, I believe that there is a much better way. And look, We're aground down here in Washington, D.C., on the good ship partisanship. I mean, there is such a... We are on shore waters of partisanship.
But this isn't partisanship.
That the third branch of the government, the Judiciary Committee, the Judiciary Branch, should be used appropriately. And I believe that's the way to resolve significant differences between the two branches, not to have the Capitol Police Force walk across the Pennsylvania Avenue the other end and grab someone and bring them back here.
But, Congressman, let me suggest to you that that is the problem, that the president goes way beyond his authority under the Constitution and says, in effect, I don't care how many American troops die. I want to do it my way. I don't care that Congress has the right to declare war. I want to do it my way. And if you want to do something about it, you have to do a court case that's going to take several years when I'm out of office. No president in American history, let me suggest to you, has ever refused to obey a congressional subpoena or ever refused to obey congressional contempt except this one. And if this Congress backs down, that sets a precedent for Congress saying we have no right to subpoena anybody.
As I sit back and listen to you, as you said, you suggest, that does not mean that this president does not suggest the other side. And the way that it has always been set up in our Constitution, however inefficient it is, and as you well know, Winston Churchill said democracy is the worst form of government, but it's better than anything else, that the resort to having to use force...
It wouldn't be that much force.
By having to... One person is too much, in my opinion, when there's a judiciary branch set up to resolve inefficiently, potentially, but effectively, the resolution by law. We have placed, our government is based on the rule of law.
But this is the rule
men.
Of law, sir. I mean, Congress has the power to require people to testify before it. I would suggest to you, respectfully, that you are abdicating congressional power to require administration officials to appear. Congress has the right of oversight. And now, admittedly, most presidents simply obey. That's the way it works. But when you have a president take the extreme position, which no president has ever taken before, that he will refuse to obey the law, he will refuse to obey your subpoenas, and that your contempt, the way it's normally done through the U.S. attorney, will not be obeyed. Again, no president before this one has taken that. Let me suggest to you that when the president acts outside his constitutional responsibilities, Congress should act within its constitutional responsibilities to make this president obey its will. Otherwise, Congress is feckless.
No, because when we voted for the subpoenas to be enforced,
right,
it also has the ability of the court itself to enforce them.
But that's never been required under the law, sir.
But it can be done under the law, and so we don't have to rely upon the Attorney General.
So let me ask you this. Let's say that 3 years from now, the court rules that you were right. It goes all the way up, you know, to lower court, appellate court, Supreme Court. The court rules that you were right. You have the power to enforce it. George Bush is long gone from office. In fact, more likely, I can tell you, as an attorney, the court will simply hold the whole issue moot. And they'll say, well, Bush is no longer in office. This is no longer an issue before us. We simply won't rule on the question. And so nothing happens. And then the next president says, you know what? I'm not going to allow any of my people to testify before Congress. And then you bring a court case, and that takes several years. And it seems to me, at the end of the day, Congress has given up its power of oversight.
You're making an assumption of that the court will rule it moot.
I think they will. A year from now?
You think. But you don't know. And neither do I know. But I do believe this, and I think I know this, having served in the White House during the Clinton administration and in the congressional side, now having the judiciary side, that the rule of law, before you use force, and if the inherent right of us to enforce the subpoena requires a man to a woman to walk with to walk over and arrest someone from the congressional branch and the executive branch, I believe that if that is the interpretation of what it is, I honestly do believe, without any question in my mind, that the greater good is where the judiciary branch by our forefathers was established to adjudicate this. I think the day that we move towards having a Capitol Police moving over to the executive branch to take a, you know, someone over is not the correct way to go about it.
Let me just suggest to you, and this has been an extended side point, but to me it's an important one because it suggests to me what many Americans see, which is a president acting way outside his constitutional powers and Congress not even rising to the constitutional powers it has. Let me suggest to you that all it would take is a sergeant-at-arms of the Capitol, which you and the House of Representatives could order him to do, to go over to the White House or to the home of Harriet Myers and demand that she be turned over along with all the cameras and all the press, and within 1 hour you'd have your testimony. And that's indeed the way the system is supposed to work. The reason we have an arrest power, a police power, whether it be the president or that of Congress, is to make people obey the law, and the president is not above the law, and I hope you will reconsider using your power, Congressman, because to me it's a broader question than just that of Iraq, but whether or not Congress will rise to the bait.
If I might have a moment to respond.
Please.
There's also the belief on the other side that they have not violated the Constitution. Now, we can disagree with that, but there is the law that establishes a Constitution that establishes a judiciary branch to adjudicate, no matter how strong our passions may be, that third branch was set up strictly because the passions may be such of men that it can do where the men become the interpreter of, where the men enforce the law through their own means rather than the judiciary branch. And I hold that as the greater good right now. Because we may violently disagree with President Bush's interpretation of the Constitution, but I firmly believe that ultimately that third branch, established under the Constitution to interpret the law, is a greater good to go about it that way. We aren't abdicating it to an attorney general. We've gone to the court to enforce it, and I believe in the greater good that how our nation was established is well above the passions that one may feel about a president and how he has interpreted the Constitution.
Congressman, I wish we had more time to debate this. Unfortunately, we don't. I do very much appreciate
you. You sure got off the topic, didn't you?
Well, to me, it is the topic because I find that Congress is not acting in the strong way that I hope you would have the power. I know you have the power in the Constitution, and I hope you would have the will to do that, even when it means, yes, it could be some strong headlines. But we could continue this debate another day. I do very much want to thank you. I know your heart's in the right place. I know if we get a President Obama or Clinton, you'll be able to do the right thing. I just wish you could do the right thing now. But I want to thank you very much for coming here.
We have two fine individuals running in the
Democratic. We've got to end the program, sir. Yes, we've got to end the program. I apologize. But thank you very much for coming here. And we will have you on again for a longer conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is an important interview. And I want to make sure you understand, I think you do, why it is an important interview. To me, this congressman shows a typical mindset. And it could be what Charlie Rangel called the Stockholm Syndrome, when you have someone who's been taken hostage and they start to ape the views of their captors. The Democrat Party has been so abused and so beaten that, like some victims of domestic violence, the Democratic Party simply caves in whenever the Republicans say go, and then moves in a slight direction against them and thinks it achieves something merely because now the Democratic Party is not submitting to the violence, but is instead saying, well, maybe 3 years from now we'll stop the violence. Look, this congressman, Bart Sestak, is very interesting, and I don't think he's atypical. He is a former Vice Admiral of the Navy, former military man, the highest military man serving in the House of Representatives. He was elected in 2006. He's a new congressman in let's face it, a fairly red district of Pennsylvania, a district that had been Republican for many decades before he took over. And he took over because the people of his district got tired of the war in Iraq, got tired of the expense, got tired of the lives lost, and frankly tired of the corruption of his predecessor, a Republican Kurt Weldon. So they elected Bart Sestak. Now, listen to what he has to say. And And that's why I think this whole contempt discussion was relevant. And he didn't want to go there. He thought it was off the topic of Iraq, which was the topic I started to talk on. But you know how my interviews go. They organically go in one direction. I follow up. He, at the end, wanted to talk about how Clinton and Obama were fine people. You know, wonderful. But that's not interesting. It's not interesting to you. It's not interesting to me that a Democratic congressman praises the Democratic nominees. No. No, I hit him on the news. I hit him where it counts. And I said to him, first on Iraq, why not cut off the funding? And he said, in effect, what I've told you all along when I've explained why the Democrats are caving, that Bush would play chicken with the troops. What he would do is, instead of using the cutoff from funds and the funds in the pipeline, the, you know, the 6 months is going to be there even if they cut it off tomorrow, to responsibly bring the troops home, in which case if he started to do that, Congress could obviously give more funds to responsibly bring the troops home. No one is arguing they should simply drop all their weapons, turn tail, and sprint out of Iraq. We understand, even Obama understands, that this is going to take some time. Obama has suggested, as has Clinton, it will take about 16 months. But if the Congress stopped the funding, the responsible thing for the president to do would be to start withdrawing the troops. Now, the president has told Congress, quietly, privately, not publicly, that if Congress stops the funding, he is going to allow the murder of tens of thousands of American servicemen and women. He will, in effect, kill his own troops rather than submit to the will of Congress. He will, in effect, if Congress stops the funding, play chicken. You know the game chicken? Chicken is a stupid game that kids play, some adults, I guess. It's more famous in the 50s. It's you have two cars, and they start heading toward each other at 70, 80, 90, 100 miles an hour. And if both stay on their path, the cars will have a head-on collision, and both the drivers will die. At the last minute, somebody swerves to avoid death, and that person who swerves is called chicken. When actually, as idiotic as he, and it's usually a he, so I won't pick on women because I usually men to participate in this stupid game, but he who swerves is actually the intelligent man, because dying is to prove some point is ridiculous. So one man swerves. The other continues. The one that continues, the greater idiot, is declared the victor. The swerver is the chicken. And if both men insist on staying the course, they end up dead. Well, George Bush believes that if Congress stopped funding, what would he do? He would leave the troops in Iraq. He wouldn't start to bring them home, as he would have no obligation to do that as commander-in-chief. Forcing him to do that requires a bill that requires two-thirds of both houses, and we don't have the votes for that. All Congress can do, the Democrats on their own, is stop funding. So he'll leave the troops there until the last dime goes. And then our troops are sitting ducks with no food, no armor, no money, nothing. And then he'll allow the terrorists to murder our troops, just so he can blame Congress. The president has, in effect, said, I don't care how many tens of thousands of Americans die, I want Congress to be wrong. I don't give a damn what the American people think, I don't give a damn what Congress thinks, and if I have to murder innocent Americans, I'll do it. That's what the president has said. Now, it may be a game of chicken, and Congress has swerved. But the American people don't realize, don't even know that the president is willing to murder innocent Americans. They don't even know that he's playing chicken with the troops. So he declares, I'm going straight forward ahead, and Congress swerves. And that's what you heard from Congressman Sestak. And you know what? I understand it. I don't agree with it, but I understand it. I think, actually, Congress should stop funding. And then as the funds trickle out and the president refuses to withdraw them, Congress should draw attention to the fact that the president is risking the lives of thousands of troops. And then probably at the end of the day, swerve, yes, and go ahead and provide the funding after the Americans learn and realize how much contempt George Bush has for American servicemen and women. No, I don't expect Congress to do that. It would be nice. I support it. But no, I understand why they don't do that. So what do? We got off on contempt. And why do we get off on contempt? Because that, to me, is a lesser game of chicken. A far lesser game. It doesn't put tens of thousands of American lives in the balance. All it does is requires a portly sergeant-at-arms, sorry, he may not be portly today, the one I recall was portly, to walk on over to take Harriet Myers. I don't think she'll resist. I really don't. Can you imagine resisting an officer? And to hold her, okay, there's no capital jail. We'll put her in an office. We'll give her food. We won't torture her, but we're going to keep her in that office until she testifies. And with all the cameras out there, my guess is she'll testify in an hour. And if she holds up for a week or two, so what? Believe it or not, there's precedent for this. And that's the precedent I was trying to illustrate to the member of Congress. Ever since 1790, how's that? America was the first president, George Washington, took office in 1789. The first year under the Constitution was 1789. And already in 1790, Congress was using its power to subpoena and to force members of the Washington administration, and clearly George Washington was a very, high-ranked president. People had a lot of respect for him, some wanted to make him king, but nonetheless, Congress required his officers to testify about various things. And from 1790 until the present, not a single president in American history has ever refused to obey Congress when Congress holds someone in contempt. Now, there's been resisting. I'll admit that. Everyone from Richard Nixon, who didn't want to turn over his Watergate tapes, to Bill Clinton, didn't want to have some of his people testify. But usually Congress only had to threaten to hold someone in contempt. The presidents understood Congress had that right, and they turned tail and they followed the Constitution. Occasionally, and it's only happened about 20 times, Congress actually had to vote to hold someone in contempt. And in every single circumstance when that happened, the president gave in. The few times, and this hasn't been done since the 1930s, when the president still held out for a little while, Congress used its inherent power under the Constitution to grab the officer and to hold him until, it was always a him in those days, until he testified. And that's been going on since 1790. Yes, it hasn't happened since 1934 because presidents since 1934 have respected the Constitution. Now, I explained this, I think, very patiently to this member of Congress. And he said, well, wouldn't that be seen as partisanship? Wouldn't that be seen as partisanship? The president is acting outside the Constitution. Congress is acting within the Constitution. And to fight back against a lawless president, Congress doesn't dare follow the law. That would be seen as partisan. I guess it's the same as saying a policeman shouldn't shoot back at the Virginia Tech killer. That would be seen as violent. Even though the police are acting within the law and the killer is acting outside the law. So what did he say? He said, well, some people think George Bush is acting within the law and this is something for the courts to sort out. No. I've done even more research on this since I've had this interview. And the courts did work it out. As I said, it happened to be 1935. I was a year off. In 1935, the Supreme Court ruled that it would not even consider this question because it's outside its powers. The power to hold an administration official in contempt of Congress is solely the power of the branch of Congress holding the person in contempt. The court said, I'm not getting involved. The courts have no power to get involved. This isn't a question that's decided by the judiciary. It's a power decided entirely and only by Congress. And 3 years from now, when the feckless, which is probably isn't the word I should have used because some people don't know what it means. It basically means cowardly and useless. But when the feckless attempt by Congress to hold the president's officials into account goes into court, 3 years from now, the court will say, we have no power. That's what we've always held. That's what we held in 1935. That's what we held in the 1800s. That's what we held in 1790. This is Congress's power. And so, Congress, you want to hold them in contempt? Hold them in contempt. But don't bother us. We don't have power to decide these things. You see, courts don't always have the power to decide things. For example, the court has absolutely zero power under the Constitution to decide where electoral votes go. None. None under the Constitution, none under Article 1, Article 2, Article 3, none under the law in the 1880s that established how electoral votes, when they're disputed, are dealt with, a law that dates back to the disputed the Tilden-Hayes election of 1876, which is why Bush v. Gore was unconstitutional. Today we have this idea that the Supreme Court is the final arbiter of all things that are disputed in America. That may be Congressman Sestak's notion. And that may be the popular notion. But it ain't in the Constitution. The Constitution gives powers to the President and Congress that the Supreme Court has no power to do anything about. When the President pardons someone, we may not like the pardon. God knows when he pardoned that traitor, Scooter Libby. I was outraged. Congress is outraged. The American people were outraged. We were outraged when Bill Clinton pardoned Mark Rich. But there was nothing we could do about it. We couldn't bring a lawsuit. We couldn't say Supreme Court overturned that pardon because we know that pardon is part of the president's power under Article 2. Well, contempt is part of Congress's power under Article 1. And you heard the congressman say, well, it doesn't specifically say the inherent, use the word inherent in the Constitution. It's just a court decision. What does inherent mean, congressman? I wish I'd had more time. Inherent means that it's part of those powers. Just as it's part of the inherent power of the president as commander-in-chief to order an army here or an admiral there, even though it doesn't say that. That's its powers. Congress has the power to get information from administration officials. Normally they cooperate. If they refuse, it is part of their inherent power to force them to cooperate. That's what inherent power means. That's what the courts have always held. But even though this has never been challenged, even though no one disputes this power, you can't find the most right-winger, I guess, that could pull someone out of the woodwork. But this has been American law for 218 years. But you heard what the guy said. Oh, no, no, we can't use force. Oh, we can't use force. We can't have the sergeant-at-arms grab Harriet Myers. That would be equivalent to, I don't know, a policeman arresting a person for using marijuana. And we all know that someone who smokes pot is far more dangerous to the Constitution than a president who refuses to obey subpoenas by Congress. Right, Congressman? What's so wrong with using force? We use force to torture innocent Iraqis. We use force to torture innocent people at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. We use force, excessive force, in arresting American criminals and innocent people every single day. Yes, there are proper uses of force, and yes, there are improper uses of force. And this is Congress's proper use of force. The sergeant-at-arms is the only police that the Congress has. And if the president were to send his army to oppose the sergeant-at-arms of the Congress, no doubt the president has the larger army. But the army at that point is required to disobey the president because their loyalty is to America and to the Constitution. Would it be a constitutional crisis? Yes, but only because the president is acting outside the Constitution. She should be in the Capitol jail. Unfortunately, they took out the jail and the base at the Capitol back, I believe, in the 30s. Because they weren't using it anymore. Why? Because presidents understood that if they were subpoenaed, their people had to testify, right? So they didn't think they needed the jail cell anymore. They didn't think that any president would be as obtuse as to pretend that he didn't have to obey the law. They took out the jail cell. So, yes, cobwebs, we'd have to put Harriet Myers in an office because the jail cell just isn't there anymore. But we can lock the office. As I said, we won't torture her. We'll give her food. We don't have to give her access to phones. Look, this to me typifies everything that's wrong with many members of the Democratic Party. You heard the congressman say he wants resolution by law, but he doesn't get that the law is on our side. He doesn't understand that Congress has this power. True, it should rarely be used. True, it has rarely been used. It should only be used in an extreme circumstance where the President of the United States refuses to obey a congressional subpoena. Oh, that's this circumstance. This isn't vigilante justice. In fact, it's just the opposite. It's the sheriff who's been sitting at home twiddling his thumbs as rampant crime is going on outside his door. And he's asked to use force to put down the crime, and he says, I don't want to use force. I'll go to court. I'll go to the judge who's hiding under the bench to escape the violence himself, the judge appointed by the very criminals who are in his streets. I'll ask the judge, and 3 years from now, when I'm no longer around, the judge will rule that I had the power to act. Why are Democrats so cowardly? Well, again, Charlie Rangel may have it. It may be the Stockholm Syndrome. It may be, though, the Democrats simply don't know their powers. They just haven't done the research. I mean, it hasn't been done since 1935, but that's okay. We're a 220-year-old country, 30-year-old country, depending on whether you count the Articles of Confederation or not. We have precedent. We have lawyers. This isn't John Yoo making stuff up. Oh, the president has a right to torture because Congress authorized the use of war in Iraq, and that means ipso facto that the president can break the law at will. No, 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 no. This is long-standing precedent. There has never been a legal decision to the contrary. This isn't even a case where, okay, well, there was a precedent one way, there's precedent the other way. No! It's the inherent power of Congress. And you see why the congressman thought it was off topic? I had told him we were going to talk about Iraq. And I understand, I disagree, but I understand Congress not wanting to pay chicken with tens of thousands of American lives. I get it. I don't like it, but I get it. I wish we would illustrate it by cutting off funding, show the American people how much the Bush doesn't give a damn about the troops, and then, if we have to, bring back the funding. You know, get a little cars a little closer before swerving. I get it. But taking Harriet Myers and Josh Bolten and holding them in a congressional office? That's an improper use of force? That is upholding the Constitution. And what is the next president to do? President Obama wins. God willing. To the extent you believe in God, fate willing. He's president in January 2009. Congress orders his administration officials to show up and testify about something, anything, doesn't matter. What should he do? Both options are fraught. He could obey the Constitution, in which case we have a precedent set whereby Republican presidents are not beholden to Congress. They don't have to obey. They simply do what they want without any kind of oversight. But Democratic presidents, because they respect the Constitution, are weaker. So when Republicans are president, they get to be stronger than Congress. And when Democrats are president, they get to be weaker than Congress. Well, that's not a good precedent. But what's the alternative? The alternative is that Obama or Clinton or any Democratic president says, precedent says that George W. Bush didn't obey a subpoena. I'm not going to obey a subpoena. Presidents never have to obey subpoenas.
Sure, it's the inherent power of Congress, but that's a 1935 law, and we all, none of us want to use force. And it would be fair. Congress, don't use force. Don't use your sergeant at arms against my people, because the Democrats didn't use it against the Republican. That's a worse choice. That's how tyranny is created. That's how the dictatorship starts. If Congress can't hold someone in contempt by force, then they can't subpoena anyone. If they can't subpoena anyone, they can't get anyone to testify unless they voluntarily want to. And if they don't want to answer a question, they can just walk out. Then Congress has no power of oversight. Then Congress has to vote on bills that the president wants without any information whatsoever. Then we have a real game of chicken where Congress is increasingly afraid to do anything but what the president wants because the president won't give them accurate information and they have no way of compelling accurate information. This is how tyranny begins. Now, I didn't have a chance to finish my interview with the congressman. Unfortunately, he got out because of time. I will invite him back on the show. I'd be willing to bet 10 to 1 he runs as far away from me as possible. Because this congressman knows what he has the right to do. He's not even a bad man in the scheme of things. I mean, he wants the things I want. He wants the troops home from Iraq. He does. He really does. He wants the people to testify. He does. We have the same goals. The difference between the congressman and myself is that if I were a member of Congress, I would use my power to achieve my goals. Whereas this congressman is afraid to use his power. He's not afraid to serve in the military. He's not afraid to kill people at the president's orders. But he is afraid to stand up for an American democracy against a lawless president. I actually think he could have been convinced. I think he still can be convinced. I want you to know I sent a long letter to him after the interview that he did not respond to, giving him the precedent, letting him know, in fact, that the courts have said, we're not going to rule on this. This is congressional power. If you don't choose to use it, that's your own fault. But don't come to us crying when you don't know whether to use your own power. Can you imagine a president being asked to pardon someone, and he says, well, I don't know if I should do this or not. I'll sue and ask the Supreme Court for permission. He doesn't have to ask the Supreme Court for permission. He has the power to pardon. Congress does not have to ask the Supreme Court for permission. Indeed, when the Supreme Court ruled in Bush v. Gore, Congress should have said, stay out of our business. You have no right to do this. I don't know why people are so afraid of separation of powers. I don't know why Congress is so afraid of sending its sergeant-at-arms up there. Are they afraid of a firefight? Do they think that the president will send his army to shoot the sergeant-at-arms? Do they really think it's going to come to that far? Power is a powerful thing. That's why they call it power. And if you have power and you don't exercise it, you are giving power away. I will continue my fight to persuade Congressman Sestic, to persuade other members of Congress this is the right thing to do. And I want you to know I've had some success. You just heard an interview where I did not have success. But if you listen to the Inside Scoop, you've also heard my interview with John Conyers, a more powerful member of Congress, a far more senior member of Congress, chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He supports holding them in contempt and using the sergeant-at-arms to do it. He says, I support it, Mark, I just don't have the votes. Congressman Jan Schakowsky, probably one of my, I don't know, I want to make her my single favorite member of Congress. She's definitely one of my favorites, maybe my favorite. She supports the idea. There are Democrats that want to do the right thing. I don't mean to say that Bart Sestic represents all Democrats, but he represents that middle from a redder district that is afraid to exercise his power. And I would urge you, whether you're listening right here live on the Head On Radio Network, whether you're listening by podcast, however you're getting this, to call your member of Congress. Doesn't matter whether he or she is a Republican or a Democrat. And ask him or her to stand up, not for Josh Bolten and Harriet Myers, and it's not about that. Stand up for Congress. Stand up for the Constitution. Stand up for exercising your power. Recognize that if you do not
exercise your power, it leads to tyranny. That's what I was trying to convey. Maybe now that you know the subtext, most of my listeners are very intelligent. You knew the subtext already. But if you didn't, you might want to re-listen to this interview. Re-listen to the archive. Re-listen to all the excuses of this member of Congress. Oh, no, I don't want to use force. Don't want to use force. Force is used by Americans every single day. I support the lawful use of force. Republicans certainly support the lawful use of force. They also support the illegal use of force. Why don't Democrats support the lawful use of force? I didn't argue Harriet Meyer should be tortured. I didn't argue she should be kept in stressed positions. I didn't argue that electrodes should be attached to any part of her body. Heck, there's not even a capital jail cell. I was going to put her in a nice cushy office, maybe a small one, maybe a closet. But you know, it was a window and food and all the rights that, say, someone imprisoned for marijuana would go. But this is the problem. Now, tomorrow I'm going to be talking to Cindy Sheehan. She and I have the same goals. She is also frustrated with the Democrats in Congress, and you're going to hear her rail on, as I have, about Congress and its refusal to exercise its power. Her solution is to run against Nancy Pelosi. It's not a solution that I think makes a lot of sense. Now, if she had a realistic chance to win, that would be different. Ned Lamont had a realistic chance to beat Joe Lieberman, and he did. He beat him in the Democratic Party. And I think Ned Lamont's challenge overall was a good one, even though I think it had some, to some extent, pushing Lieberman away from what Democratic principles he had, even more into the arms of the Republicans. Now, as you know, he has endorsed John McCain. But Ned Lamont was a different case. He had the power to win. He had a chance. He had a realistic chance. And he went for it, and I supported Lamont. I don't feel the same way about Sheehan. I don't think she's making the arguments I'm making, where I'm picking off members of Congress one by one by one and encouraging them to use their power under the Constitution. As I said, I succeeded with several, including very powerful members like Conyers and Schakowsky. Didn't succeed with Sestic, but hey, I could work on him. You could work on yours. But Cindy Sheehan has joined up with some known terrorist groups, including those in the Muslim Brotherhood. We'll talk about that tomorrow. And by doing so, I really think, whatever you feel about the Israeli situation, whatever you feel about whether the war in Afghanistan was correct or not, these are things, let's face it, on which 90% of Americans agree. 90% of Americans do not think that Israel should be destroyed. They don't. 90% of Americans do support our war against Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. We do. Cindy Sheehan, I think, should focus on the war in Iraq, where she and 63% of Americans, including me, think we need to get out. Responsibly, but as soon as possible, as soon as practicable. 16 months of Obama sounds about right to me. But she hasn't. She's let her agenda be broadened to these other issues that, frankly, have extremely small support. Now, she's a free citizen. She can advocate whatever she wants. She has free speech rights. But she doesn't do, I think, the movement to end the war in Iraq any good by allying with people who have larger and more dangerous agendas than she. By allying with people who, let's face it, don't have her best interests at heart and certainly don't have the interests of Americans opposed to the war in Iraq's best interest at heart. There was a recent peace rally in Washington, D.C., about 2 weeks ago. I reported on it then. 23 organizations supported that, including some pretty radical anarchist organizations. Less than 200 people showed up, about 5 per organization. Code Pink brought about 20, and the other 22 organizations brought another hundred or so. They went to protest the IRS, which doesn't make any sense. I mean, Congress and the president set our policy. Protest Congress. Protest the White House. Don't protest the poor bureaucrats at the IRS. Don't block the entrance to their doors. It doesn't make sense. And they did so in the most inane and silly way imaginable. They dressed up in pink and sat in beds. And yes, they have the right to do whatever they want as American citizens. I am not saying they don't have the right to do this. I'm just saying it's stupid. 180 million Americans opposed the war in Iraq. And they couldn't get 18 million, 1.8 million, 180,000. They couldn't get 10,000. They couldn't get 1,000. They couldn't get 200. And yet some people consider them our leaders? They're not my leaders. What I think we need is a broad-based movement.